Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, life inside North Korea. We hear from a Catholic aid worker who travels regularly to the isolated Asian nation. And Big Brother in a Benedictine habit, the success of reality TV shows in a religious setting. Welcome to the programme. More than a decade after Caritas, the Catholic Church's aid and development agency, first started helping people in North Korea, the isolated communist country is changing fast, yet many families still find it very hard to survive. That's the view of Kathy Zellweger, one of the very few Westerners to have travelled extensively inside North Korea, despite tough government controls on all foreign activity. Originally from Switzerland, Kathy has spent over a quarter of a century in Asia working on humanitarian aid programs with the Global Confederation Caritas Internationalis. From her base in Hong Kong, she first began visiting North Korea in the mid-1990s as reports of starving children began filtering out of the famine-hit nation.
Our program really started in summer 1995. That summer they had terrible floods and they asked the international community for assistance, and Caritas was one of them, and that's how it all started.
Take us back to your first visit to the country, the kind of impression you had when you first went inside the country.
Oh, in those days it was totally different. I mean, you really felt it was an isolated place and people would not look at you, they would avoid eye contact, you had no links basically, it was just a totally different world. And that has all changed, it's now more relaxed. Of course, if you are a newcomer, it's still not relaxed, but for me, having the opportunity to compare over 10, 12 years makes a big difference, so I do see changes.
What would you say are Caritas' greatest achievement over this, well, more than a decade now?
Oh, I think we have saved thousands and thousands of lives by providing the much-needed food aid in the crisis years, 1995 to 1998. And even today, also the North Korean government is requesting development aid. I still believe there is a big need for humanitarian assistance. And we need to watch the situation very, very carefully and see what kind of humanitarian assistance we still can provide.
How difficult is it for you and other humanitarian aid workers to really be able to assess the needs of the people there? How easy is it to travel around outside the cities, for example?
There are still, of course, restrictions. You need travel permits. But in my case, once you have been given the travel permit, and if you have a good North Korean companion with you and you know perhaps the people on the ground in the counties or villages, you have established relationship and trust, then the difficulties are much, much less.
So in other words, the image that we have through the news stories that come out of difficulties with the government, once you get to a local level, you're saying that's quite different.
My experience is that at the local level, you're really welcomed and they appreciate the help. I mean, they appreciate our help at the top level, too. It's just that there is internally, are there some tensions about all these foreigners in the country? Not that there are that many, but still. So a lot is bargaining, negotiating. And I think that's one thing I had to learn in Asia, that you negotiate everything. And that takes time and patience.
What about the mentality of the average North Korean family today? How much are they aware of the international situation and the situation regarding their own country? How much access do they have to media now, for example?
I think the access to international news is still very limited. Also now, every Sunday evening, they have a 45 minutes TV program about international news, so at least that. But in the countryside or in the areas where the situation is still very difficult, I think for the average family, it's a struggle for survival. And you are concerned about how can I feed my children? Will they get schooling? What can I do if somebody falls ill? That has priority, and not thinking about, you know, bigger issues.
How much is health and education and these other, as you say, basics of life? How difficult is it still for people to get that in the poorer areas that you're visiting and looking after?
Healthcare is still in a very, very dismal state of affairs, and a lot needs to be done in that sector. WHO is helping a lot, UNICEF, and then some aid agencies like Caritas, but the needs are very big. In terms of upgrading the present system, upgrading hospitals, but also the training component comes in too. And that's a change from the last few years, that we are now able to do more capacity building projects. So there has definitely been a greater awareness that there is a need to learn in a variety of sectors. So that's again positive.
How much does the development of the country, do you think, help to stabilize the political situation?
That is a hard question, but I think with the changes, like with the establishment of markets, with people now receiving salaries instead of government handouts, the mindset of the people is changing.
Describe to us a little bit, if you can, life in the city right now in Pyongyang. You're saying there's a huge change even from just a decade ago.
What has changed is, for example, that there's more traffic, more cars, more bicycles. People are dressed more colourful. There are markets. Small-scale businesses have been established. Everybody, I think, now talks about costs and prices. This wasn't on before because people simply took what they received, and now they have to make ends meet. And that, of course, for many, I think, is also a problem. And I see that have and have-nots are developing. And therefore, for Caritas, it is very important that we follow this trend and see how can we help those that are falling through the net, the sick, the poor, the marginalized, the excluded.
We're talking about the humanitarian situation. Of course, North Korea is largely in the news at the moment for the current nuclear tensions over its nuclear capacity. How much do you think can international pressure on the government help to resolve this current crisis?
Personally, I do not believe in pressure or sanctions because most of the time they hurt the wrong people. I do, however, believe in negotiations and in a constructive, non-threatening engagement.
And yet the six-party talks broke down quite some time ago, and it seems difficult to find a way through this current deadlock.
With the six-party talks, I felt probably North Korea felt threatened because, you know, there were more partners on the other side than on their side. And I think eventually a direct dialogue with the US has to happen. Maybe this threats with a nuclear test, perhaps that's also an outcry to say, can we not talk? Or do we have to take more drastic measurements?
What role does South Korea play in this? Because on the surface it would seem that perhaps the South Korea is most obvious negotiating partner to begin with, as a bridge between, if you like, the two sides.
Even with South Korea, the situation is still very, very complex, and there are still many, many hurdles to take. Also, South Korea is trying very hard to engage North Korea.
there are, of course, many families, aren't there, on both sides of the divide between North and South Korea, and the family reunification program at one time seemed to be bringing the two sides a little closer together.
That is still happening, that they have from time to time these family reunion gatherings, and I do think that is very, very important. But I also feel the younger generation in South Korea has a very different outlook, because for them it's not that close anymore. It's over 50 years. So it's no longer a topic which was discussed at the family table before, you know, relatives in the north, because, you know, the clock is ticking. And those who still have relatives in the north, they are all in their 80s and plus.
What about the role of the church in South Korea? Traditionally, the Archbishop in Seoul is apostolic administrator also of North Korea. Is there any way that the church in the south can play a stronger role in trying to forge ties, in trying to ease tensions between the two countries?
There are different groups in the South Korea from the church who are trying to establish more in-depth links with North Korea. How far we have come, I don't know. We have very little information about the situation in the north. I still believe maybe among the group that goes to the Catholic Church in Pyongyang, the Changchun Church on Sunday, where it's only a prayer service because there is no priest. I do believe among the old people there might be some Christians, but it's hard to tell.
Is there any interest amongst younger people, for example, about religious faith of any kind, perhaps not just the Christian faith? Do you ever...
Very, very little. Only because when I'm there, I usually go to church on Sunday, so occasionally my North Korean companions would ask a few questions, why and what is this all about? Or they would listen in and, you know, join the service, but that's about it. Otherwise, it's hardly ever discussed. However, whenever I meet officials in the countryside, I always explain what Caritas is and what we stand for.
You say you've been working there for over a decade now. What really gives you hope in the country there when you're working amongst the people?
Well, I think at the end it is the people where you see that you can have an impact and you can help them to move forward or help them to help themselves. And sometimes we tend to forget that there are 22, 23 million North Koreans who want to just lead a simple, ordinary life like you and I. Because all we read is, you know, the political issues, the nuclear issues, whatever. But there are millions of people who have the same desires as we have.
Kathy Zellweger there, who's moving from her job as head of Caritas Hong Kong to Pyongyang, where she'll be running a humanitarian aid program for the Swiss government's Office on Development and Cooperation. Now, Big Brother in a Benedictine habit. That's what many viewers were expecting when they first heard about a new reality TV show being filmed inside a Benedictine monastery in the south of England. Five young men from very varied backgrounds were invited to spend 40 days inside the monastery, cut off from the outside world, living alongside the 22 monks who make up the community at Worth Abbey, while a TV crew filmed their often comic and sometimes coarse attempts to live a more spiritual life. The five selected candidates included a soft porn filmmaker, an ex-member of the paramilitary Ulster Defence Association, a student of Buddhism, a publishing company executive, and a retired teacher, none of whom knew much about the Christian faith, yet all of whom said they were enriched by the experience. The three-part series entitled simply The Monastery was first shown in Britain in May 2005 and was so successful that 1 year later a follow-up programme was made to find out what long-term changes those men had undergone. At the same time, a similar series was produced about four women in an English convent, and both British shows have now been copied by American TV companies. So is this the new face of religious broadcasting? Has there been much resistance to this opening up of monastic life? And why are so many non-religious viewers so fascinated by what are, in fact, overtly spiritual programmes? Questions I put to Father Christopher Jamieson, abbot of the Benedictine community at Worth Abbey, where the monastery was made.
First of all, the whole idea of reality TV fills the air at the moment here in Britain and indeed around the world. So it had a marketing edge of being able to pretend that it was going to be like reality TV. In fact, it wasn't like reality TV, but so it was cleverly marketed in that sense. Secondly, having hitched people's interest, we were then able to lead them into an area of life which many people crave, namely a place of stillness, a place of reflection, and to do that with characters who were very modern characters. In other words, the viewer could identify with Tony, with Gary, with the others who came to the monastery and could feel, hey, that could be me doing that. And then finally, they discovered that when these very modern men did this, they gained a lot from it. So they were hooked in, they were led to see something going on that they'd like to do themselves, and then they saw how very beneficial it was. And so I think, if you like, vicariously, they experienced the fruits of contemplative living in their own living room.
It was your task, wasn't it, to guide these five men and the rest of the monks at Worth through this six-week experience. How much of a challenge was that for you personally?
It was very nerve-wracking at first, but once we got to meet the five participants, I relaxed a great deal because I realised that these were very open-hearted and generous men who'd come to us. They came from very thin, minimal religious backgrounds in most cases, but they came with a very generous and open heart, and they also came with a good sense of humour. So that made us all relax and enjoy the process.
Did all the monks there at Worth support your decision to go ahead with this project, or did any of them voice any real concerns, or do they just simply do as you tell them to do?
It's a modern monastery. It's not quite as simple as saying do this and everybody does it. We run a consultative process, just as St. Benedict asks in his rule, that when there is a big decision to be made, let the abbot consult with all the brethren, because God often speaks through even the youngest, as Benedict says. So we consulted, and there were concerns, and we then addressed those concerns, went back to the production company with these concerns, had a very good dialogue, the community met the production team, and gradually the concerns were reduced to a minimum, and we all agreed that we should go ahead with it.
The idea, as you say, cashes in, if you like, on the huge success of all those Big Brother reality TV programmes. Didn't you ever worry, perhaps at the beginning, about the idea of cheapening monastic life or dumbing down, perhaps, yes, Benedictine spirituality?
Absolutely. Big Brother Goes to the Monastery was the sort of nightmare that I began with. And indeed, I challenged the production team to say, look, is that what you're intending? Because if that's what you're intending, then it's no deal. However, as I went through the dialogue with them and as they spoke to the community, it became clear that they had a very, very different motivation. And I began to realise that there was, in religious communities in this country, in the whole Catholic community in this country, we have acquired a very defensive frame of mind towards the media for all sorts of reasons, and many of them justified. But I realised it was a moment to overcome that instinctive defensiveness and to realise that maybe God had sent us a group of media people, a production team, who really did have a different agenda, who wanted to show how religion had something to offer the spiritual life of the people of this country. We began to realise that this really was the case, and so we thought we really must be open to this now. Thank you.
And yet this tension, if you like, between making the faith accessible and dumbing down, if we can call it that, it really seems to me to be one of the most interesting questions in the church today. Should Catholic leaders be preaching to the converted in a language that really very few people understand these days? Or should they be trying more to reach the increasingly large majority of people who have nothing to do with the church?
The absolutely critical issue which we faced in a very practical way. Interestingly, the practical choices make themselves when it comes to it. There's a very interesting theoretical discussion to be had, but at the practical level, when you're presented with an opportunity to speak to the wide mass of people who are not religiously engaged, you take it. I can't imagine St. Paul saying, "This looks a little risky, I'll have to go and think about it." St. Paul would have stood up and preached. And I think that within the boundaries of common sense and prudence, we have to take the opportunities that present themselves to address this wider audience. And I'd add to that, I'm increasingly developing a mental picture which is very different, if you like, to the mental picture of the Catholic Church in Britain in the second half of the 20th century. I think in the first half of the 21st century, we need a different model in our minds. And my model is now this. Every person who comes to church on a Sunday is a bonus. Every person who crosses the threshold of a church just to come into it is a bonus. In other words, we start from an expectation that people in this country are not religious. That's the basic expectation now. And therefore, every time we find a way of inviting them to come towards the church, we rejoice at a new bonus. We don't go around saying, "Isn't it sad that there's such a decline in the numbers of people coming?" We talk ourselves in a different framework, which is that we say, look, the basic expectation is that we now live in a society where most people say, "I'm not religious." But the good news is that they usually preface it by saying, or they usually add to that, "But I am spiritual." And we have to start to show how religion is at the service of spirituality without an agenda that is trying to just make the numbers look good. But rather, we have a religious offering to feed the spiritual life of the spiritual people of this country.
Like other religious orders, of course, the Benedictines are struggling to find new recruits. Do you think the success of this television series will perhaps help to turn that around at all?
Well, before the series was aired, we had had a number of people who came to us interested in the monastic life, and they joined the community as novices just after the programme was aired. So it looked as if there was a sort of instant success, but actually it's not quite like that. However, we have had an increase in the number of people inquiring and some quite serious inquiries. And our conclusion is that the programme has enabled people to approach us more confidently. It's led to an increase in the self-confidence of the people whom God is calling to the religious life, that they now feel it's easier to respond to that call.
I suppose that partially answers my next question, but who do you think benefited most from this project? Was it the five men who say their lives were somehow changed by their experiences, or was it you and the monks at the Abbey, or was it the 3 million viewers?
I think we were all winners. That's the reality. The community was given an enormous confidence that our way of life still speaks strongly to this generation, as it has done to hundreds of generations before. The five participants all received something, and in the case of several of them, received a life-changing experience. And perhaps the most unexpected one, though, was the number of viewers who've been in touch with us in their hundreds and thousands to say that their lives were touched and changed by the programme as well. And when I say touched and changed, many people have been in touch with us to describe a process of viewing the programme, being moved to contact us or to contact the local church, joining an RCIA program, joining an Alpha program, coming on a retreat with us, some step like that, which has then given them the confidence to seek baptism and to join the church. So that has been a truly remarkable outcome, that a TV program could be such an amazing channel of conversion. And so for me, the biggest winners are undoubtedly the ordinary people of Britain who've discovered the life of the Catholic Church feeding their spiritual lives very profoundly.
Gloria in excelsis Deo.
The monastery is now heading to the United States, isn't it? Where a similar program is being made about a monastery, I believe, in New Mexico. Can you tell us anything more about that? And whether you think it is a kind of program that can be exported with the same kind of success?
Well, the Tiger Aspect has now completed filming at the Monastery of Christ in the Desert in New Mexico. And they've also completed filming at the Convent of Our Lady of Mississippi in Iowa. And in both those monastic communities, they had outsiders, men and women, who did the 40 days, as happened here at Worth Abbey. And they're now editing those programs for transmission in the US by the Learning Channel.
Do we know when they may be going out or not yet?
I think they're going to go out sometime in the autumn. We don't know anything more than that at the moment. But what I think will be interesting will be to see to what extent the very different context of American religious life affects both the way the participants interact with the monasteries and also affects the way the viewer interacts with the program. The reason I say this is that in America, of course, there is a very high level of Christian religious practice with some 50% of the population in church on a Sunday morning. And in some areas of America, of course, it's much higher than that because there are some parts of America, mainly on the East Coast, where the average is lower. So you can find in America places where there would be as high as 75% of the population in church on a Sunday morning. Now that means the whole of the background is different, because what was, I suppose, particularly striking in the British experience was that the decline of religious practice and the decline of religious knowledge in Britain meant that there was, I think, a new territory out there of people who had not lapsed, who had not rejected religion, but for whom religion was a foreign country. As Tony Burke in our series said, religion was for me just a source of good jokes. And I think that that is not the case so strongly in America, and I think that changes the way the interaction works. So I'll be really interested to see how that goes.
And my thanks there to Father Christopher Jamieson, abbot of the Benedictine community at Worth Abbey in the south of England, where the TV programme The Monastery was made. Brings us to the end of today's feature program, but we'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programs on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org and click on the English icon. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.